Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 58 of the Uncovered Podcast. I'm your host, Behram Kazi. You can find me at DefMango on Twitter. And with me is Jared Kimber. As always, you can find him anywhere and everywhere. But the group stages of the World Cup are complete. We have our four semi-finalists and we'll be talking about each of them, plus the semi-finals, of course. And we also have exit interviews lined up for each of the other teams which didn't make it. But before we get into any of that, Jared, how much did you enjoy this group stage compared to group stages of the past? Was this underwhelming? Was it par or was it better? What's your take?
This show leans in hard on data and technology, so we are proud to work with HCL Tech, leaders in their field.
I mean, there wasn't a lot of close games, and I suppose New Zealand made it more interesting towards the end, which saved us a little bit from the Dead Rubber song that I would have sung every episode. But I mean, it was okay, wasn't it? It'd almost be better if there was, like, I don't know, two outstanding teams and then a bunch of other sort of mixed in teams, or everyone was a little bit not great and you weren't sure who was going to win. It did feel a little bit inevitable for India from a long way out, just because of, you know, Australia, South Africa, and New Zealand having such obvious flaws and struggling at times in this tournament. But Afghanistan and Afghanistan and New Zealand kind of made it more interesting than it had to be, I suppose. From a competitive side of point, it's the first World Cup where everyone's won two games, right? So that is absolutely huge. And I think that's proof that cricket has got a lot stronger overall, not just, you know, a handful of teams being strong. But I don't know. How did you feel?
I mean, like, when we were staring at potential 19 dead rubbers, I was like, oh, well, this is going to be exciting. But we did get some close games after that. I particularly enjoyed Pakistan versus South Africa, Australia versus New Zealand, Afghanistan versus Australia. Might be missing a game or two. But yes, I mean, if I compare it to 2019, because that's the more comparable one, right? Same format and all that. I feel like when you had the quarterfinal, you know, setup or structure, that kind of took a lot away from the group stages because it's lower stakes and there's a very, very good chance you qualify for the quarters, right? Unless you absolutely have like a stinker, which I think someone did, right? Back in 2015? Who missed out?
2015. England didn't make the quarterfinals.
Yeah, there you go. So
yeah, I mean, the quarterfinals thing, we're probably now at a stage where quarterfinals make more sense just because, like, look at the bottom two teams of this, and they are probably, you know, of a better quality than we've ever seen before. We can't have quarterfinals in a 10-team tournament because there's no point actually having the other part of it. I would much rather it just be split into two groups of five, play a bunch of games, you know, in different locations against the same team. You get a bit of a better understanding of everything then, and then we could go on and have a quarterfinals. Or Super Sixes is also a fantastic format because it's like a knockout without a knockout. Do you know what I mean? So there's many different things that you can do to have a more interesting tournament than we have had. But I think the majority of the more exciting games were in that back half. So considering we also had some jeopardy, I mean, it never really looked like New Zealand were going to miss out. Perhaps if Afghanistan had beaten Australia, that would have changed things a little bit. But, you know, I think there was some jeopardy towards the end. But look, I don't know how fans feel. For me, it's just felt like a very, very long tournament. To get towards the semi-finalists that we probably thought we were going to see about 3.5 weeks ago.
Yeah, no, I concur. It's gotten rather long. I think, what, 40-something days of consecutive games, and now we finally have a break. I love today. I went for a haircut. It was a very nice day, you know.
I've got a haircut booked for tomorrow. My wife wanted me to do something this morning, and I said, I'm going to sleep in. And she's like, no, we need to. And I went, I need to sleep in. Just let me have this day, please. So I'm with you.
Yeah, I hear you. Also, we've got Ritam Bhattacharya, Raj Rohit, Subhajit Ghosh, Akko, Anmol Srivats, Shubham Patel, Josh Ward in the comments. Hello to all of you. And Raj Rohit actually has a super chat. So before we actually get into all of the fun stuff, let's have that chat on. All right. Raj Rohit says, we got top four by game 25, but this is long round robin required to find bottom two. SL in Netherlands, Sri Lanka and Netherlands came in with qualifiers and they finished 9th and 10th, top 8, not in that order, but they finished in top 8. Where's the question?
I think what he's saying is, what is it worth having a longer tournament so we can find out who the bottom two teams are? But I'm not really sure we need to know who the bottom two teams are. Like, we do now because they put the Champions Trophy in. But a World Cup should not be about where you qualify for a Champions Trophy. It should be the other, if anything, it should be the other way around. Right. This is, we've got this all backwards. We're trying to work out who's going to qualify for Eastbourne by who does well at Wimbledon. Like, things don't, I don't know if Eastbourne's still a tennis tournament, but it used to be. So look, I definitely think there, it's just a backwards way of making this happen, and it didn't need to exist. And I don't think the Champions Trophy should be linked to the World Cup in that direction. If you want to do it the other direction, you go, look, if you finish top six in the Champions Trophy, you get automatic qualification to the World Cup. I'm like, well, that's fair, because that is a smaller tournament and that's how things should work. You shouldn't be coming seventh in a World Cup and then be like, now you can qualify for this other tournament that we're actually might be a T20 tournament anyway, and we don't really know what it is, and we've cancelled it a couple of times, and it's had about three or four different names, but it's very prestigious because you qualified for it by being good in a World Cup where you only had to be not the very worst teams.
Yeah, I do concur with that logic. And I think top eight ODI teams was better logic in a way, because you get the best eight teams to play the Champions Trophy. But I will say this, that it did make things interesting, right? Like, you have that added layer of, not expectations, but that added layer of, just that will to perform better. Even if you're languishing at ninth, you want to win the next game because, you want to qualify for the Champions Trophy. But yeah, I don't like it this way. But anyway, let's get into it then.
Yep.
All right. We also have Shubhad, Shraba, Sabot, Krishna Singh, and Mrinal Kanti Nath in the comments. And he has a really fun thing. He said, who's batting disappointed you more, Babar Azam or Max O'Dowd? Brilliant question. We'll come to it. Anyway, India, let's start with them. They remained unbeaten throughout the round robin stage. And as expected, they dominated the Dutch in their final game. That too in Bengaluru, scored 400 plus. Rohit, Gill, Kohli, they got 50s. Shreyas Iyer and KL Rahul got tons. KL scored the fastest ever ton by an Indian batter in World Cup cricket. And they've got the best bowling attack, right? There's daylight between India and the rest of the teams. And the bowling attack's been so good that, so much so that nine bowlers were bowled by Rohit in this game. Rohit himself brought himself on towards the end, got a wicket. Kohli got a wicket as well for the first time in 9 years in ODIs. So, it's pretty much the best time to be India, isn't it, Jared?
Yeah, I think almost from the start of the tournament, certainly even before I was talking about, there weren't a lot of weaknesses in this side. Maybe if you can get them 6 wickets down under 35 overs, you can put a little bit of pressure on them. But if you get any team 6 wickets down under 35 overs, you can put pressure on them. And the other biggest issue is, of course, if a bowler gets injured. But if New Zealand or Australia have a bowler injured, they're going to be in a much worse situation, even with part-timers available to them, than India are, because they've at least got 4 frontliners. So, look, I'm not particularly worried about that at all from India's point of view. The biggest issue is, and there's no way you can control this, so it's not something that they need to worry about, but they have had a team where everyone has been in form. And so you are going to get to a point where, like, maybe a few players drop off a little bit just because it's hard to maintain form for 11 games. India have never won 11 games in a row in ODI cricket history. So it would be a big deal for them to be able to do that as well. They might have to, grind out one of these wins, but they still look like the best team ever. Just to see, a guy called Sham has said, accept it or not, Steve Smith is still the greatest batter of all time. I mean, he's really not, but I just saw that come up. I mean, he's not.
Maybe in New South Wales.
No, Bradford's from New South Wales. He's not even the best player from New South Wales. Anyway.
That's hilarious. Yeah. I think, I mean, you hit the nail on the head with that. Like, I don't think India could be better placed. And yes, there is a bit of that fear that, hey, we haven't lost yet. That loss better not come in the next two games. Knockouts will have their own pressure. I want to see if Rohit can continue to go hard successfully at the top and whether or not they change that strategy. I think if I were New Zealand, you know, I would want Rohit Sharma and Virat Kohli back in the hut as soon as possible. No one has done that yet. And those are the two main guys up top who are experienced, who have the runs. They're absolute bona fide legends, you know, of cricket. So those are the two big ones, I believe. But really, everyone's in form. Every single batter has gotten runs. There's not a single guy. Maybe Surya Kumar Yadav. He's that one guy who hasn't gotten
as many runs. But he played in innings towards the end of one of the other games, didn't he? I mean, I suppose he's the weak link, but he's also kind of supposed to be the weak link, as in he's trying to play that butler role, right? And again, if you got them 3 wickets down within the first 15 overs and you have an attack that has Santner and Nisham in it that can get out, chisel out one or two in the next 20 overs, I think you can put a lot of pressure on them, right? But we haven't really seen anyone have, no one's bowled as well with a new ball as India has. The only bowling lineup I would say that should be able to dismiss India for something cheap would be the Indians at this stage, right? And also, New Zealand's best new ball bowler of recent times is Matt Henry, who's not there anymore. So it doesn't mean that Tim Southee can't have a day, or Trent Bolt, who hasn't taken a lot of new ball wickets in this tournament, can't have a day or anything like that. All those things are possible. But as you currently look at it, it's like they just look like the better team.
Yeah. I mean, if in the instance that they do lose quick wickets and both Rohit and Kohli, you know, they might miss Pandya in that game, even though it doesn't seem like they miss him at all at this point. And they do have a bit of a long tail, but then those top six batters, they're all pretty damn good, aren't they? And they've all gotten runs as well. So I think, maybe New Zealand should be scared of facing Virat Kohli in the middle overs, particularly if he rubs the ball on his butt cheek, because that got him Scott Edwards' wicket in the most farcical fashion. Great feeling.
Yeah. I mean, I think what we probably need is Virat to take a wicket in the World Cup final, just because of how ridiculous it would all be. But look, there's, you talked about them being pretty good, you know, having a very good top order. I mean, historically, they've got a great top five. And so KL Rahul, who everyone in India still reminds me is so crap, is still averaging almost 50 in ODI cricket. And there aren't that many players in the history of the game who have a record anywhere near the level that he does. You then have an all-time number seven as well. You have someone with Sky who maybe, obviously they would prefer to have Hardik in there for multiple reasons, but gives him more flexibility and everything else. But, you know, everyone's got to deal with their injuries. You know, we could talk about how bad England were with the ball, but Jofra Archer wasn't there, right? Like, these things happen to teams all the time. And so, you know, you certainly, you have a situation where there isn't really a weak player. What they had lack at the moment, which they had at the start of the tournament, was that little bit more flexibility with Hardik. And they don't quite have that at the moment. But look, I thought they were the best team coming in, and I haven't really seen anything to shake me. And I think they've actually played. My big worry was that they would play defensive-minded cricket. And outside of one innings, I can't remember who it was against, but where Virat made 100 off 120, and where it was noticeable he was slowing down with some wickets falling, they haven't really gone back to that defensive mindset. That said, if you look at 2003 Australia, they were a team who actually didn't score that many runs, but it didn't matter because you couldn't score 200 against them, right?
True.
And I don't know if India's quite at that level, but certainly from a strike bowler perspective, they're every bit as strong as Australia were in 2003. From that, but the game's changed a little bit, so you'd have to give some inflation there. But the point being is they could play now the way that Pakistan wanted to play, right? Which is make a par total. Maybe you get lucky at the death, and then you're just like, well, good luck scoring a par total against our bowlers.
Yeah. I mean, you spoke of a weak link, right? That bowling has no weak links. It's as complete as India's ever had in the format, at least. And then also, you know, the batters, you think of maybe Shreyas Iyer as being like the least celebrated batter out of all those guys. And he's just scored a ton, right? A quick fire ton at that. But
he's just a good player as well. Yes.
Oh, yeah. I love Shreyas Iyer in these conditions. I'm willing to see how he fares or keen to see how he fares, you know, outside of India. That's still something I'm yet to see. Like he needs to perform over there to become like a really, really come into the conversation. But on these surfaces, he's really, really good. But one question for you is that I've seen or noticed that at the Wankhede, right, whichever team is bowling second, they get a lot of purchase up front. Afghanistan seamers did great versus Australia. So is this going to be an important toss to win for either side?
I mean, it would be hard to say that it's not going to be just based on what we have seen so far, right? So I don't want to over-index on that. And just purely because people get a very, very obsessed with that. And, you know, and to the point at which they make it feel like there's no point playing the game, right? The best score in the second innings so far is Australia. They still made 293 in that second innings. Bangladesh made 233 with a broken batting lineup against South Africa. But we've also had, 170, 55 scored as well. I think that Wankhede has played up a little bit under lights, right? And I'm more than happy to say that that is the case. But I also think Australia batted pretty well after that when the steam went out of it. Now, whether all teams will be able to do that or not is a very, you know, it's not a particularly easy thing to do. But Mamadullah made 100 later on. And Maxwell's made 100 later on. The other two teams didn't get to later on. Right. So, look, it's going to be tough. There's a few grounds in India that they've kind of fit that sort of template, right? Of it's not always easy to bat in the first innings. There's something for the spinners. There's whatever else. But if you get to a par score, you can take a lot of wickets under lights and then cause problems. But that doesn't seem to last very long. And then you've got the whole Jew situation and everything else. So I don't want to over-index on it, but it could be an issue for sure.
Yeah. All right. Before we take a break, let's just move on to New Zealand real quick and discuss them. Now, you know, they had a pretty poor run in between. They lost 4 games on the bounce, but then they won their final game versus Sri Lanka quite convincingly at that and basically killed off the group stage. But a good thing for them is that Trent Bolt is back to his best. Like, he looked really, really good with the new ball versus Sri Lanka. Mm. Of course, Kane Williamson is also fit again. Rachin Ravindra is firing and he's having an unprecedented sort of World Cup. Lockie is back as well. So they've got their enforcer in the middle overs. And then Daryl Mitchell has had a pretty decent World Cup. So I mean, I don't think that, I think that if there was one team that India probably didn't want to face in the semifinals, it was New Zealand, because they did somewhat run them close in Dharamshala, and they have that history, you know, with India in World Cups. But do you think that, you know, pound for pound, this team can upset India?
It shouldn't. Hmm. If Matt Henry was there, I'd feel a lot different. But, you know, as it's currently set up, it shouldn't beat them, but it can. Just on those losses, so they lost 4 in a row, as you said. This is why I do this sort of stuff. And it was, I've been talking about it a lot, but this ridiculous comments. I think it was on an Uncovered episode where anyone was going on about ifs and buts. The reason this channel is ifs and buts. So if you don't like that, you're in the wrong place. Go find somewhere else. But the reason I talk about that is New Zealand lost 4 games in a row. I thought they played reasonably well against India. They put some pressure on India. They got them 6 wickets down, right? I'm not saying they almost won that game or anything like that, but they put some pressure on India, certainly more than like the rest of the league has. The Australia game, so they went within what a hit of winning that game, right? Like they were right in that. And that was after Australia absolutely massacred them up front. How many teams have chased better than New Zealand did in that game in this tournament, right?
None.
Maybe Pakistan versus Sri Lanka, but they didn't have to chase 390, did they? Right?
Yeah, and I mean, Stark had even bowled a full toss to Jimmy Neesham, so it was literally there. They could have won it.
Exactly. South Africa, New Zealand, I think that is a legitimately bad game, and that might have been one of those games where they were caught a little bit you know, under the lights. That was Pune. I know it's not Mumbai, but you know, they're basically, it's the satellite city, so it's close enough.
Yeah.
It's the Geelong to Melbourne, if you need it that way. The Milton Keynes to London. Anyway. And then the Pakistan game, they made over 400 in that game. And then the rain obviously played a big part. I'm not saying Fakhar didn't do amazing things. He deserves to get his credit and everything else. But in the end, Pakistan had to chase less than 8 runs and over to win that game. Well, they 7.8 runs and over to win. I still think they would have won that game. So if you look at those four losses, I would say in three of them, they actually played really, really good cricket. Now, the issue is that they still have to get 10 overs out of someone. Perhaps if Rohit's in or Gill's in, I think that fifth bowler is going to get absolutely met, right? But if it's Virat and it's Rachin Ravindra, maybe Shreyas will go after him a little bit. But if Shreyas goes out, they might have to pull back a little bit. And there are chances, I suppose, that they can make that fifth bowler work. And their batting is a little bit similar to India's in some ways, isn't it? Maybe slightly stronger at the number eight position. But they've got players who could obviously score as well. They're not quite at the level of the Indian players. But, you know, Conway and Mitchell and Williams and who knows, Ravindra might make a 100 in this game for all we know.
Glenn Phillips is still there, you know.
Glenn Phillips still hasn't done anything. He's still like a coiled spring waiting to attack, right? So they've got a lot of weapons as well. But pound for pound, they're not as informed and they're not as good a team as India. But that's not how knockout games work. Yeah. One reason why New Zealand is so good in knockout games, well, specifically in World Cups, but also in knockout games in general, not so much winning them, but competing in them, is because their players are natural problem solvers, right? Mm-hmm. India hasn't had to... What's the biggest problem India have had to overcome? Mitchell Marsh's groin, perhaps, in that early game, and then losing the sixth wicket against New Zealand, right? They haven't really had the same amount of challenges that everyone else. That's not to say they couldn't overcome them all. Like it's a bit like saying, well, the problem with the Australian 2017 was no one challenged them. So that they won that tournament with, you know, that's fine. And India might still do that. When it gets tricky, right? New Zealand had four losses in a row. They had lots of tricky moments in those games. They are used to all that sort of stuff. India isn't quite at that level. And we know that New Zealand is very good at those sorts of situations. That, look, you know, I'd still have India as a massive favorite because I just think they're so much better. But it's not impossible.
Yeah, no, surely not. And I mean, New Zealand have a habit of making it to World Cup finals, right? They don't have a habit of winning those tournaments, but they do get to the finals fairly frequently. And at least, well, two out of two times in the last two World Cups. So that's a good statistic. But I'll say this, and this is kind of working off of what you just mentioned over here, is that, you know, those losses, the Australia one and the Pakistan one in particular, you know, in one of those games, they nearly chased down 400. And in the other game, they scored 400 and lost. Whether or not they'll win is a different story, but they have been, you know, the fourth best team in this competition. And that goes without saying. And they deserve to be there. So, I mean, they should play without any sort of fear. And there's nothing to lose over here. They've already overperformed. So
there's no expectations, is there, really, on them? They're not even seen as the biggest, like, choking team, which, like, I was saying this on something, I might have been on the earlier show I did today, the scoreboard, and I was saying that, like, if you took South Africa's history out of the World Cup, New Zealand would be the team we talk about for choking, right? But they don't have that kind of history, and they've just won a World Test Championship. So, look, they've got every chance of winning this, and you know, maybe it's 35% chance winning, whereas India have a, you know, should be massive favorites. But if you played this game 10 times, I don't think India win all 10, right? I do think there is a chance that, you know, New Zealand win 1, 2, 3 of those games in that situation. You know, because tosses, drop catches, one spell, you know, who the pitch favors, all those sorts of things. That's, knockout games are just a very different beast. And in some ways, I think we've seen with, so there have been five winners of World Cups who haven't lost a game before. But this will be the most, I think, I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying this. This will be the most games that any team has won in a row in one World Cup. Because I'm trying to remember if 07 or 03. I don't think they had to play 11 games in those. I think it was 10.
In 07, it has to be more because they were playing three games in the initial group stage. And then they had the Super 8. So that's 3 plus 7 plus 2. 12.
I can't even remember. There were so many games in that tournament. That was long. Maybe Australia have slightly more, but the point being that three of those tournaments that have been won without a team losing a game were a lot shorter. I think Sri Lanka had to win six in a row. West Indies won five in a row a couple of times. So this is slightly different than we've ever seen before outside of, as he quickly counts. Yeah, I think it might be 11 in 2007 as well, just off the top of my head. But the point is that that was Australia in 2003 and 2007 combined the best ODI side we've ever had.
Yeah.
Not to say India can't do all that. It's just, Australia could have gone to the West Indies, got on a pitch that didn't particularly suit them, and a similar thing happens. New Zealand in 1992, certainly, I think, were at the very least should have been finalists and were probably the best team. South Africa in 1999 is another team. West Indies in 1983, we've seen really, really good teams in World Cups not win before. And, we might see that again, or India could just be like, we're Australia of 2007. We'll pick up our trophy now, if that's okay with you all.
Yeah, I mean, anything is possible. And I think you've drawn some really interesting parallels over there as well. It's India's World Cup to lose. They are the best team. I would even say that they deserve it, even if, what's his face? Bhushali Nag thinks that Bairam is a Pakistani who is supporting New Zealand from heart and praying for India's loss. Well, you can think what you want to think, but I think India does deserve this, whether or not they win
it. Just on that, we see a lot of comments like this, right? Like, it's just nonsense. Because I tell you this from a couple of different reasons. I've worked with a lot of Indian people in cricket in my time and a lot of Pakistani people in cricket in my time. Once you work in cricket, you don't actually follow cricket the same way anyway. Mm-hmm. So this fan stuff that you guys project onto other people is nonsense. Also, in Bayram's case, correct me if I'm wrong, you grew up in Canada, you would have had probably Indian origin friends or even Indian friends who were born over there that you would have hung out with, right?
Well,
you guys have
got to
stop projecting. Yeah, exactly. You guys have got to stop projecting your own nonsense, right? Both of us think that India is the best side in this World Cup. And I don't want to speak for Bayram here, but it's obvious because we both have our eyes and we're cricket analysts, right? We both understand that they are the best team in this World Cup and that they will most probably win it. I always want the funniest thing to happen, right? Mm. So I think the funniest thing to happen is for some reason Virat Kohli has to bowl the last over. Trent Bolt plays a flamingo shot where he tries to hit it through point, gets it through his legs, and then there's an overthrow and it's a tie. And then we go to the super. Anyway, the point being is when you project stuff like that, it's you who looks like a biased person, not Bayram.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I concur. But anyway, we've got some super chats over here and Prateek Jha is over here. What's up, Prateek? And you've also got an imposter, Prateek Jha, under him. That's interesting. But Orville Dutenbacher, one of my favorite names.
Sorry,
and
I got
Parth.
No, no, you go Orville first.
All right, perfect. So Orville says, just realized I hadn't contributed when both of you were streaming. Thanks for the amazing content. Well, yeah, thanks for the love. We appreciate it, Orville. Now let's go to Parth. According to Jared and Ian Chappelle, he's Dave's brother. Warner is not ambidextrous. He is a kleptomaniac. Oh, you've gone thief now.
Ian Chappell, when he was talking about Dave, do you remember David Brain? Might have been before your time. Was it David Brain? He was a Zimbabwean cricketer anyway, who I want to say threw with his right arm but bowled with his left arm, but it might have been the other way around. And Ian Chappell got a little bit confused and said he's a kleptomaniac. It's still one of my favorite, because when you commentate, you make those mistakes all the time, but it's such a brilliant one to make sense.
Yeah.
But I know what this question is going to be. I can see it already. So basically what Parth is saying is, look at all the modern day great batters like Lara, Sachin, Sanger, Stokes, all are klepto. I think what he's saying is a lot of great players are, not that they're all ambidextrous, but that you see Warner, Lara, I'm trying to think of some of the others out there. Michael Clarke, Adam Gilchrist is another one. Mm-hmm. Heaps of these players who are actually they bat left-handed, but they're actually right-handed, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we have learned about cricket over the years is that we decided very early on what was right-handed and what was left-handed. It's probably the other way around. And your dominant hand actually should be on top of the bat, not under the bat. And I'm really annoyed with this because I believed this when I was 14 or 13 maybe, and I was going to switch and I didn't. And I always regretted it afterwards. I should have batted left-handed. But that's a big part of it. And so what you're talking about then is not actually people being ambidextrous or kleptomaniacs, hopefully. What you're really talking about the fact is that we have never fully embraced the fact that batting is a two-handed pursuit. We decided this is right-handed and this is left-handed. What if that was the original mistake rather than anything else? And other sports are different, right? And in baseball, you want your stronger hand to be on the bottom. But in cricket, you probably want it to be on the top. And so you know, both my sons I made bat left-handed. It turned out one of them was left-handed, so I'm now thinking about switching him. And my daughter, I haven't worked out what a dominant hand is, but whatever it is, she'll be doing the opposite.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, right? Because you see switch hits today. And maybe if what you're saying was realized earlier, maybe we sort of would have seen switch hits earlier or something. But anyway, this section has gone too long. We have lots of teams to talk about. So we're going to take a break. And we'll be back with the Uncovered you're watching, yeah, with Behram and Jared. So we'll see you soon.
Get ready to take charge of your favorite leagues in Wicket Cricket Manager. Control the game, buy and sell players, and train them to victory. Play against friends, strangers, or challenge yourself. With your cricket knowledge, become the master on the pitch of Wicket Cricket Manager.
Welcome back to the Uncovered with Jared and Behram. And I see that in the comments, both the Pratik Chahs are debating on which one's the original. So I don't know. You guys let me know whenever you've decided. But we're going to move on to South Africa. Now, they won their second game chasing versus Afghanistan, but they still don't look particularly comfortable chasing. And yeah, I mean, there's some positives over here. Of course, Gerald Coetzee, he's been one of the stories of this World Cup. He took another fourfer. I'm a fan. I think he's one of my favorite breakout stars, along with Rachin Ravindra. Then, of course, Rossi got another score of 50+, and he's picked up form at the right time for South Africa. And yeah, they've got rain forecasted in their semi versus Australia for both days, even the reserve day. And, you know, they've finished second in the table. So if this gets washed out, South Africa go through to the final. But this is South Africa, and this is rain, and these are World Cups. It just, it's an uneasy feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be fascinating to see how that affects them and ruins their chances again. Look, I think they're a good side, but we know what the issue is. I mean, we barely need to go through it
You know,
compared to the other teams. But they had four chases in this tournament. So they chased terribly against the Netherlands and lost. They chased terribly against Pakistan and somehow won. Against India, they didn't chase. And then against Afghanistan, the thing about this is, I've written about this for a video coming up, is you look at that chase against Afghanistan. If that was Pakistan or Sri Lanka or Australia or any other team, you'd be like, well, they were 5 wickets down. They put on 60 or 70 for the last wicket and they got there with a few overs to go. You'd be like, that's fine. But it didn't look fine. It didn't look comfortable. It looked like it was going to fall apart at any moment.
For Fef Lekweo, I thought it was falling apart.
Yeah, and he was fantastic, I thought, as well. Mm-hmm. Also, he played with the freedom of someone who didn't matter if he got dropped the next game, right? Because he's not expected to play anyway, which does help, I suppose. But, you know, they look, I wouldn't say they look as good as India in when they bat first, but they look in that ballpark of India when they bat first. And when they bat second, they look like Pakistan of this tournament, maybe?
I suppose so.
Do you know what I mean? So not terrible, like not... It's not like they shouldn't turn up, but they, you know, they've won two and lost two when batting second, which is what did Pakistan? They end up 4 and 5. Yeah, do you know what? That's kind of what they look like, that level. And also, they could roll the team out with their seam bowlers one day, and then only have to chase 150, and none of this matters. Although, what South African would be comfortable chasing 150 to knockout game? Probably none. But there's so much talent in that team. They've obviously got their issues as well. They don't seem to be able to understand how to bowl to the tail, which is certainly a part of it. They over-attack with the ball, which I love, but it does seem to come back and bite them. I've got no problem with them over-attacking the first 25 to 30 overs, but I wish they were better at bowling defensively in those last 20 overs to match it.
True.
Obviously, there's the whole Marco Jansen thing of I kind of feel like he's already made all of his runs in this tournament and he can't possibly do it again. But he's carried them as the number 7 bat and with the new ball. So, you know, there's issues there of how a young player is going to go in a World Cup in knockout game.
I also think Demba is captained well. That leg slip that he has for Marco Jansen, I'm a fan. I really, really like that tactic.
So I went through all of Marco's wickets. I can't remember when this was, but I went through a bunch of his wickets. He's got so many caught down the leg side. I don't think I've ever seen a one-day bowler get that many wickets. Especially in India, like, because a lot caught down the leg side, quite often it's a bounce thing, right? And I know he's freaking 19 foot tall and all that sort of stuff. But even so, we're still talking about Indian wickets and they've had good bounce, but he's just been getting so many wickets in that way. And it's a bizarre thing to look at when you go through and it's like, oh, he's getting new ball wickets. What's he doing? Swing it around. No, he's bowling at people's ribs down the leg side and they're getting tickles.
Yeah, yeah, it's quite outrageous, really. And I do feel like they have the bowling attack to win this game. And Victor Siwafiwe, excuse me if I mispronounced your name, he asked that, do you all think South Africa will be at a disadvantage because of how bad they did in Kolkata versus India? I just think that they're at a disadvantage if they bat second, as plain and simple as that. That's really the truth. And I think they are the second best team in this tournament when they bat first. And that tells you a lot about the level of competition over here, because India is just so much higher above the rest, right? And Australia will come to them in a bit. But I feel like, you know, the fact that they've lost that game versus South Africa in the group stages, that's going to give South Africa some confidence that, hey, we beat these guys before, we'll beat these guys again. And this team does not have the baggage of previous South African teams. They make the final. They've already made history, haven't they?
Yeah. I don't know if they don't have the baggage, because we heard a lot about that in 2019. And then when it really push came to shove, it looks like they had the baggage again. I don't think it's a... I just think with the success and the amount of cricket that those guys play in different situations around the world and everything else now, I don't think it quite means the same as maybe it has at other times. You know, playing for South Africa is not as important as it has been in the history of South African cricket, right? Like, even South Africa don't even play ODI games anymore, and, you know, they're prioritizing their T20 and everything else. It's the lowest stakes that South Africa might have ever felt going into a World Cup semi-final. If they're chasing 220 and Zampa gets his third wicket, I don't think that matters. Right? If they've made 350 and Mitchell Marsh is, you know, 100 off 120 balls, I don't think that matters. Actually, Mitchell Marsh will be 120 off 100 balls, won't he? But do you know what I mean? Like, that is when the pressure just will come back naturally. I don't think it matters at the start of the game. The toss is probably going to play, you know, a bigger part in this. The weather might play a bigger part in this. But it's when you have that moment in a knockout game. Because it's not just that they're going up against Australia, right? They're going up against World Test Championship winning, World Cup T20 winning Australia, right? There are players here, and not to mention there's a couple of 50-over World Cup winners in this side as well, right? Well, yeah, two. Is that right? Well, Stark, and am I missing someone else? I can't remember.
Steve Smith.
Cummins must have as well, I think, 2015.
Cummins, Hazelwood as well. They're a lot.
I don't know if Hazelwood... I don't think Hazelwood played 2015 because I think Faulkner was around there. But he was around
Faulkner
anyway.
Faulkner was around, yeah. He was around. But Warner was there.
Warner, yeah. So there's... Do you know what I mean? So you've got guys who have won World Cup, T20 World Cup, and a World Test Championship in that side. And South Africa just doesn't have that, right? Like, there's no way of getting... That's not a choking or inherited sadness or Richie Beno's hex comment. That is a legitimate... The Australian players are used to playing in very, very big games with huge things on the line and winning a good share of them. South Africa is not used to any of that. And so it is different for them.
I do hope that, and I know that, you know, I'm not taking sides over here, but I really hope that South Africa can shed that joker's tag, because at times it feels a bit unfair. So if they do win, I'll be really, really happy for them. But let's move on to Australia. Of course, now they have won 7 games in a row and they have Glenn Maxwell to thank for that. But we'll come to that. That's actually not going to be part of this podcast. We're not talking about Glenn Maxwell because we're doing a Footmarks on Glenn Maxwell. So you guys should tune in over there, because there's so much to talk about over there, and we don't want to ruin any of that fun stuff. But that was arguably one of the greatest ODI innings of all time. And, you know, had he not saved them, they could have been in a spot of bother. You know, that game versus Bangladesh could have gotten tricky, but then it wasn't tricky. Smith and Marnus got 50s. Mitchell Marsh remained unbeaten on 177. That's his career best ODI score. So the top three, and even to an extent, I suppose, if Steve Smith's gotten runs, that's a good sign. They all look solid. And Australia, they are contenders. They're always contenders. But for some reason, it just feels like this team is missing something, right? I mean, the pace attack picks itself, and as does Zampa, Maxwell, the top three. But numbers 4, 5, and 6. I have a bit of an issue over there.
I think that's fair. I mean, Maxwell would be one of those, but you kind of mean 4, 6, and 7, don't you? Really?
Yes.
I think. Yeah.
Inglis, Josh Inglis, Steve Smith, and Marnus.
Yeah, but also Stoinis as well, right? Like, you know, there's...
Does he play?
Well, I mean, I'm just assuming, but I'm saying either way, you could put Cam Green in that as well. There's no, you know, there's a lot. That doesn't work about everything. Here's my question for you. What's their most complete game that they've played, do you think?
That's a good question. So they scored big versus Pakistan, but then Pakistan kind of got close at one point, but then they killed it off.
And also they scored big against Pakistan, but had a massive collapse.
Yes. Right. And then they scored big versus New Zealand, but they nearly lost that game, right?
Correct.
And then let's scored not under look par at Afghanistan.
Yes, scored under par against England. Yeah. As you said, the Afghanistan game, I mean, should have lost that game.
It's a miracle that they won that game.
I would say their two best games have been against Bangladesh and Netherlands.
Yeah, that's apt. And that's a worry, right? And
it's no idea, is it?
So 4, 5, and 7 or whatever is an issue as is. But, you know, their paces, Pat Cummins, Josh Hazlewood, and Mitchell Starc, those are three of the most decorated names in contemporary cricket. And they've got the experience. They've won stuff. But they haven't turned up like they usually do. If you take out that opening spell versus India, there's not much to write home about. And it kind of feels like they're relying heavily on Adam Zampa over here to get the wickets.
Yeah, I don't know if they'd still be in the tournament without it. I mean, if Adam Zampa had had a normally good tournament, I don't think they'd still be in the World Cup. So Hazlewood is averaging 31, going at 5 runs and over, 12 wickets. Perfectly respectable World Cup.
Mm.
Cummins is averaging 43, more than a run of ball. And Starc is averaging 44 at 6.5 runs. Right. And if you look at their part-time team as well, Stoinis is going at 7.5 runs and over, has taken a couple of wickets when he's come on. Mitch Marsh took a couple of wickets as well, but he's averaging like 46. And Cam Green, I think, bowled 3 overs against India. I think it was India. Yeah. Certainly bowled against India, whether they're all against India. Right. That is as bad as Australian team can probably get, right? Like Sean Abbott came in and bowled better the other night. They would be legitimately thinking to themselves, do we drop Mitchell Starc for Sean Abbott, right?
Mm.
And that should not be a question they've had. And this is a couple of, this is the last two T20 World Cups and now this one, where they've had question marks over Cummins and Starc at various times. It's not an ideal situation to be in. I don't know if they can win the World Cup with Zampa alone. I mean, to be fair, that's very unfair to Maxwell's bowling, which is which has stood up. I mean, Maxwell's going at, I know he hasn't taken any wickets, but he's going at just under 5 runs and over. So as a defensive bowler, he's been absolutely fine. I think he was whacked out of the attack versus Pakistan, maybe. New Zealand. No. New Zealand might have been. Someone got him anyway. Yeah.
Hmm.
But the point being that Zampa cannot continue to take as many wickets as he has been. I mean, eventually he has to stop taking 3 and 4 wicket hauls every game. Maxwell is going to get whacked in at least one of these knockout games, you would assume.
Mm-hmm.
Hazlewood is holding the fort, but he's not doing anything. They can't go without Cummins and Starc having at least one good game each from here on in. I just don't believe that they, unless it's completely, they make 400 batting first and, you know, South Africa have to chase or something. Do you know what I mean? Unless it's that sort of thing. At a certain point.
I mean, they could make 250 batting first and South Africa might still
do you know what I mean? Chase. Yeah, exactly. But what I'm saying is, if you take out the South Africa factor, those seamers are going to have to take some wickets.
Yeah, no, and I think it's funny how Mitch Starc had to have one poor World Cup to start complaining about two new balls. That's what it took for the ODI goat.
That annoyed me so much when I saw that, because I was just like, well, wait a minute, 2019, you had two new balls and no one could get anywhere near you, right? Mm. Let's not talk absolutely. You're just not bowling very well. That is what is happening here. You're not bowling very well because... And then, of course, that's going to restart the same conversation. And no one ever talks about a problem. No one ever says the very basic thing of, why don't we fix the ball? No. Why don't we go back to an equally crap system that we had from before? But we've done that before.
Yeah. Also, for whoever is, you know, interested in that sort of stuff, Jared and I have done a Footmarks episode on it. So you can go into our archives and look for it. And yeah, we spoke a lot about what's wrong with two new balls. But anyway, just to close off this topic before we move on to the exit interviews, South Africa and Australia is a big game, right? They enjoy an interesting rivalry. Sandpaper Gate also intensified it. The players often have a go at each other. You know, it gets a bit hostile. And then there's the 99 World Cup semi, of course. You know, it still haunts South Africans to this day. And then the one-sided fixture or semi-final in 2007. That's the two times they've met in the semis. This is a big game. I mean, I would argue that this is the biggest game thus far of this World Cup because India and New Zealand, you expect India to win.
Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, if New Zealand beat India, that's the bigger game, right? Like, yeah. But if India win, then yeah, this is the first one. They're flawed in different ways as teams. I don't think either of the teams are particularly good chasers, but Australia is probably a little bit more set up to do that. I think South Africa has better form when everything's working, but worse form when everything's not working. And Australia has so many match winners. Like, for instance, there's nothing to stop. Stark could take 5 for 70 in that game tomorrow, do a Harris Ralph, and then we're all just like, okay, well then that's just what's happened, right? And that's the kind of situation that Australia is in, and kind of always has been. I mean, this is a very Australian World Cup. If you take out 2003 and 2007, and probably 1987 as well. There is an element of things falling in place for Australia at the right time. You know, in 99 is certainly a good case of that. 2021 was another good case of that, right? Things just kind of fall together and then they do very well. There's a very Australian side of things there. But South Africa's got a fantastic team. They've got players with lots of experience now. They know their game. They know India. You know, like, I can't see how South Africa win if they have to chase, but if they bat first, it could be a really interesting game.
Yeah, no, and I just hope that Quinton de Kock gets a ton in this game, regardless of the result, because then he'll have 5 tons and he will be Quinton de Kock. But anyway, on that note, we will take a break. You're watching Uncovered with Jared and Biram, and stay tuned for Exit Interviews. Welcome back to Uncovered, episode 58. You're with Jared Kimber and Behram Kazi, and we have a super chat. So before we actually get into the teams, we have to see what Yash Palmer is saying. And he says, what are your thoughts on a 3-match series for semis and finals in World Cups? Is it a clusterfuck? Well, I mean, we saw it in the World Series that used to happen in Australia. I did kind of like that, but not in a World Cup, not for me.
It depends on what you want your World Cup to be. If they actually, if we play this massive league situation, right? It doesn't really make sense at the end of that to play 2 knockout games, right? Because a massive league, the one advantage of having a massive league like World Cup is that you should find out who the best teams are. But that was not the case in 1992. Probably more the case in 2019, but you could argue that India at least deserved to be in the final. So a similar sort of thing happened there, right? If that's what you would want, then is a best of three situation. If you are desperate to see who the best team is. I would probably prefer it to see it in the PSL and the IPL and the Big Bash and some of those other leagues, right? Just because that absolutely ridiculous that, you know, you some of those leagues that you can play like 15 games and then get to the end and you only need to win 2 to make it through. So that if you want to know who the best team is, probably a best of 5, a series would be the best way of doing that. But a World Cup, there should be an element of you have to be the best at the right time and you have to work through problems in, you know, as they occur or as they happen to you. And so what we've got here is half of one tournament, half of another all put together. So in this particular format, it would have been much better if the semifinals and the finals were best of 3, if we're being really honest, but it would have just made it even longer. And I can only say from looking at some of the numbers, you know, some of the data I've been given by broadcasters and others, there was a wane in this tournament. And I think that if you had a 6 games of a semifinals, I think there would have been a bit of an issue there with interest, especially if one of those series was really one-sided or everything else. But I don't disagree with the concept, but it's never going to happen. They are never going to do it.
I personally disagree with the concept because I love knockout cricket. And I think knockouts add an extra element of excitement to World Cups and tournaments because, you know, weaker teams can dream. And I think that's beautiful. But anyway, let's start with Bangladesh. They barely qualified for the Champions Trophy. Their batters, barring Mahmudullah, they all failed hard. They did not score consistent runs at all. In fact, I think that in the final game, they finally got their batting order right. And I was really, really happy to see Tauhid Ridhoi get some runs. He got a 50. So we had talked about him prior to the World Cup, and I'm happy that at least he, you know, somewhat kept the faith. But yeah, their bowlers didn't take enough wickets. They were very, very underwhelming. And it was quite an abysmal showing for a team that we just, both of us, expected better than 2 wins out of 9 from, right?
No, definitely. I think they probably were worse. Well, if you're looking at pure form, I would say they were the worst hit by form in this tournament, in that England at least got something out of their bowlers towards the back end, and then their batters also started to make a couple of runs, right, towards the back end. Whereas Bangladesh, essentially, their batters never made any runs and the bowlers couldn't take any wickets. And if you look at all the, you know, their batting was certainly getting a lot better coming into that World Cup. And their bowlers have been fantastic between the cycles. Sometimes these things just happen, and it could have been a couple of, you know, key bowlers having injuries. It might just be that they went too defensive. They are a very defensive mindset team in what was a very attacking World Cup, you know, strategically and the way that teams batted and bowled. You know, so maybe they were playing the wrong kind of cricket at the wrong time. But I would, if you're asking me what actually happened, and this is it's a combination of two things. I think it was it was certainly a little bit too early for some of those batters like Shanto and Rudoy, who were just coming into their own and suddenly had to play the best bowlers in the world maybe weren't quite ready for that challenge, which is fine. You know, we see that. But the other one is, I just think too many of their best players weren't in form. And you can't really legislate for that. So peaking is something, obviously it's been talked about a lot with India, but peaking is a really interesting concept, and you can do everything you want. But as a team, you have 11 players with 11 different kinds of skills and jobs within the side. I don't think it's physically possible to make sure they're all peaking all the way through a World Cup, or they're peaking at the right time or anything else. Once you lose form, and we've seen it in every T20 league in the world, you usually go through a prolonged period where where your star players aren't doing anything. I think that is the main reason, which is probably not what Bangladeshi fans want to hear. They probably want me to sack the coach and, you know... Whatever, I haven't even been following how Bangladeshi fans have been handling this because of the whole Sri Lanka mess.
Well, our coach just said that don't start with Bangladesh, man. It's pure pain. Well, I mean, I get it. But I would just like to add to whatever, like everything you said makes sense. But I would just say that maybe some of the off-field controversies also, you know, hampered their progress because it wasn't particularly ideal.
Yeah, I don't think that bothered their younger batters though, right? And what... Honestly, I see what you're saying, and maybe it played with the general malaise of the team, but I don't see that's why they wouldn't take wickets anymore. Do you know what I mean? Like, at a certain point, you have to just be honest here and go, everyone was just not informed the way that they should have been.
I mean, the important takeaway over here is that Bangladesh's highlight of this World Cup was timing out Angelo Matthews. And I find it hilarious that this is the team that Manka did Ish Sodhi, called him back to bat. And then they timed out Angelo. So yeah, that's one of the great quirks of our game. And speaking of amusing, I also find it absolutely hilarious that Pakistan had their hopes pinned on the Sri Lanka-New Zealand game getting washed out in Bengaluru. The forecasts were with them. That whole Kudrat Ka Nizam arc was also with them up until that point, because all of these games were, you know, the results were in their favor, and somehow they were alive. In classic Pakistan fashion, they were alive. And it started belting in Islamabad and other areas of Pakistan. And when I say belting, I'm talking about a hailstorm. That's how much it rained. So Kudrat played a trick on Pakistan, and that's just really, really funny to me.
Yeah, I mean, Pakistan, where do we start? They probably didn't get as much out of batters that they would have expected more from.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think their batters were massively out of form, but they weren't machine-like. They weren't churning out those 320 to 360 scores consistently. But when it comes down to it, we said before the tournament, we didn't know how they were going to take wickets in the middle. They added not taking wickets at the top, right? They were, at times, they bowled okay at the death, maybe towards the back end of the 40th over, you know, that 35 over mark period. But their spinners completely fell apart. I'm sure a lot of people go, oh, Jared said they would. I didn't think they'd be that bad.
I mean, their best performing spinner was Usama Mir, who took 4 wickets at 62. And Nawaz and Shadab took 2 wickets each, and they were averaging over 100. That's bad. Your best spinner was Iftikhar in a way, because he was giving you those, you know, buffer and overs. And
he went at 8 runs and over in the power play when they had to. I mean, do you know what I mean? Like, just nothing worked. And Shaheen and Harris Ralph ended up with decent amount of wickets, but their wickets didn't matter as much because of when came. And look, perhaps if Pakistan were making 350, that 350 type totals almost every game, Pakistan bowlers would have worked out a way to make it happen. But that also wasn't happening. They weren't putting pressure on the other side of the ball. And this is why I've been saying with Pakistan for a long time, they rely so heavily on their bowlers being able to strike. And in a situation when their batters were 5% under par, 10% under par, which is, that's going to happen in a World Cup. We just talked about Bangladesh being far worse than that, right? Like Australia have been under par, but Australia have got, have managed to bring it together when they've had to, or their batters have batted, the few batters who've made runs, like, you know, Marsh and Head and Maxwell and Warner, have made them at such a pace that they've overcome that. And then Zampa has pulled it along. Pakistan just didn't have any of that, right?
Yeah. And I think if I were to rank all of the blunders or mistakes or shortcomings, let's call them shortcomings, shortcomings. Power play wickets is probably number one because, like you mentioned, Pakistan has been a strike bowling team and wickets up front is what wins them games. Not only did they not take power play wickets, and I think Shaheen is a good example over here. 18 wickets in the tournament at 26 apiece. They look like good figures, but three of those wickets came in the power play. Right, yep. So you have to take that thing into context. And
what was Harris Ralph's bowling average in the power play? Do you remember? Is 130
something like that? Because every like time he came on to bowl,
yeah, I think it was 130 runs from like 85 balls with one wicket. Yeah. Like, wow. And Iftikhar got smashed in the power play, didn't take a wicket, and Hassan Ali, who they dropped, actually was the only one. And again, he wasn't brilliant, but he's the only one kind of taking wickets in the power play as well. Yeah. So. It was a really, really exceptionally poor tournament. And, and if you look at that, if the batting is 5 to 10% under what they needed it to be, their power play bowling was like 80% under where it needed to be.
Yeah.
And the already bad projections that you and I had for their spinners was well under. Mm. That's three parts of the game that you can't overcome. This isn't a selection issue. This isn't a preparation. Like, as far, you tell me if I'm wrong. But there isn't like two other Pakistan spinners that can bat that they could have brought into this side to give them more depth. You know, the truth is that they were a flawed side to begin with, and a lot of things had to go right for them to be good in this tournament. And we talked about that before, and it completely lived up to what we said.
Yeah, and I think that losing Nasim kind of exposed their pace attack because he was that bowler, all-phase bowler who could bowl defensively, still take wickets, great at the death, great at the power play. And he made Shaheen and Harris a lot better, you know. That allowed them to, or having Nasim allowed them to attack more, get more wickets. And I think that's a big piece of this puzzle. But, you know, the paces were, you know, poor in the power play, wayward, erratic. The spin attack was non-existent. Pakistan dropped some crucial catches. The Warner catch versus Australia is one of those turning points in the tournament. Had Osama Mir caught on to it, you never know what the result would have been in that game because they did bat decently. The fielding was abject. You know, the ground fielding versus Afghanistan particularly, then they got bowled out in 5 out of 9 games. And that game versus South Africa in particular, had they just batted out their overs, they would have won that game.
They shouldn't be getting bowled out with that batting lineup. Like that's a, for me, that's an automatic batting lineup in a way that Australia isn't, for instance. Like Australia does, as we talked about, you know, Australia does quite know about their three and their four and then that further on and everything else. Australia, we have seen them be absolutely brilliant and absolutely terrible. Pakistan had built that to be a consistent batting lineup. And then, I don't think they were terrible with the bat in many games, right? But they also weren't anywhere near the level that they should have been in very many
games.
Not even close. You know, if they're 10% under par, they're probably 30% from where they want to be, right? Like, you know, they're a long way away from how they would hope to be in a situation like that. So, that was pretty poor from them, but they've taken it really well, from what I can tell. And there's absolutely no panic back in Pakistan about all this.
I mean, Morne has already resigned as the bowling coach, so you can expect a lot of chaos. They've already had a lot of chaos, right, with the PCB and everything. And I don't know if you missed this or not, but the PCB threw their players under the bus even when they weren't out of the competition. They issued this press release in which they quote unquote just said that, oh, well, I'm paraphrasing, not quote-unquote. But they basically said that, hey, your team's still alive, support them. But yeah, we'll assess everything after the World Cup. And
you're all getting fired if you don't make the finals. And you shouldn't make the finals because you're rubbish.
Yeah, but one last point I'd just like to make, and then I can be done with this rant and we can move on to the next team, is that, look, Babar Azam is an elite ODI batter. He was averaging nearly 60 in the format over 100 games prior to this World Cup. And he averaged, what, 40-something, 310 runs in the World Cup, 450s, neither of which were impactful. Maybe the New Zealand one was a good one. But barring that, Babar just didn't Babar. And forget the batting, but even his captaincy was quite under par at times. So, yeah, those are all the reasons that I think Pakistan, you know, cost Pakistan.
Put it this way, what was the thing you would say Pakistan did better than we thought they might be able to do in this tournament?
Nothing.
That's what I mean. There isn't a single thing. I don't think they were outside of the spin bowling and the power play bowling, I don't think they were horrendous in like every facet of the game. And, you know, I'm sure we'll come on to England later. And obviously we talked about Bangladesh, but there was nothing that worked, right? Like the things they thought would be okay weren't particularly okay. And the things that we had worries with were way worse. And then one of the things we were hoping would work also didn't. Like it just didn't work for them.
Yeah, and I mean, they lost 5 games in the World Cup for the first time ever. So that is a pretty apt representation of how things went for them. But up next, of course, are Sri Lanka. If you thought Pakistan was bad, well, shit's just about to hit the fan, right? Because, well, their batters were impressive in isolated patches. You know, we saw some of them score well. Nisanka got to 50 a bunch of times. Samara Wickrama had a good innings, as did Asal Lanka, and Kusal Pereira in the end scored a 50. But yeah, no, their batting probably was better than it had been coming into the tournament. But then they got bowled out versus India for 50-odd. And the bowlers were also below par, I'd say, barring Madhu Shankar. I think he was absolutely phenomenal. I think that they've unearthed a real gem in them. And yeah, when the batting wouldn't work, they would fall like a house of cards. And that was bad. And now Sri Lankan cricket, as things stand, is suspended. And yeah, I mean, everyone's sacked. No one knows what's going to happen. They're probably the worst performing team at this World Cup.
Well, I was going to ask you who you thought. That was my first question was going to be, do you think they were worse than the Netherlands? And this is not a... Look, I think Netherlands and Sri Lanka, whoever you pick as the worst team is probably the best worst team we've ever seen in a World Cup. So it's not as bad as, you know, it's not as bad as... We're not comparing them to Namibia of 2003, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you've got to be a little bit realistic when you say that. But Madhushankar aside... I'm not sure really there are many things to take away from this tournament. Tikshana didn't really take any wickets.
Tikshana scored more runs than Angelo Matthews, and Angelo Matthews took more wickets than Tikshana.
What was the final? No, they were level on wickets. You don't worry about that. I've been obsessed with that, but you're right. So Welalage and Partharana came in. They both played, I think, 2 or 3 games. They both averaged in the 90s. So there's your youth core that you were hoping would be able to carry you with a couple of injuries. Mm-hmm. They got wiped off the map. They were desperate to get Shamira back in. He averaged almost 100, I think. 98, just bringing it up now. Tikshana averages 63. And I think overall in one day cricket, he averages about 28. And he's playing in Asia. You expect him to at least hold those numbers or be within touching distance of those numbers. Kumara, they played him in a couple of games. He went at like 7-8 runs and over. Angelo Matthews is like their second best bowler, right? Danajaya De Silva, who had really, really good numbers with the ball coming into this tournament, just absolutely, didn't help them at all. Again, I'm trying to think, am I missing anyone else in that list? I'll just have a look. Danajaya De Silva didn't take a wicket.
Yeah. And he didn't score any runs either.
I mean, he had a dog ordinary World Cup, right? So their bowling, that was, and for those of you who don't remember, that was their strength, right? Mm-hmm. Now, yes, they didn't have Hasaranga, but they did have like the majority of their other bowlers available for certain games. And so many of them were just no good. I think you're right about the batting. I actually think their batting overperformed. It was probably a very similar batting performance to what we saw from Afghanistan, maybe with 4 players rather than 5, right? I think that's probably fair. It was very similar to Afghanistan, though, except for the fact that when Afghanistan had one batter stand up, that batter would go on to make 100, which would impact the game, right? Yep. So Ibrahim, even Ali Khil, Omazai.
Hashmatullah.
Hashmatullah did it in another. Do you know what I mean? So when those guys had an innings, even if no one else made runs, the team could make 20s and 30s around them and get them to a decent total, which they could defend, right?
Yeah.
Whereas with Sri Lanka, even if their batters got them to something, it didn't matter because literally Madhushankar was going to take wickets and then the rest of them were just going to get slapped around everywhere. It was
basically
really, really disappointing. The whole thing. So I know a little bit about what happened with the ICC, and I haven't been following the news story, so this might already be out, or it might not be. But essentially what happened was that it was so bad that Sri Lanka cricket asked the ICC to suspend them.
Wow. I saw a comment from Arjuna Ranatunga who said that Jay Shah is responsible for this. I didn't look into that news. But that sounds like Arjuna, doesn't it?
I saw that as well. No, so what happened was it was all going to hell. And this is not the first time this has happened. I think the same thing happened in Zimbabwe. I think South Africa tried to get a similar thing as well. Because once your government gets that involved, there's nothing you can do other than, and also, there's a difference between the government getting involved, which happens in cricket all the time, and one part of the government wanting to do one thing and another part of the government wanting to do another thing. And you've got these rival factions and everything else. And so it is my understanding that Sri Lanka cricket was like, we can't fix this, right?
Yeah.
The only thing we could do now is have a suspension and have a reset so that these people can't get involved anymore and we can start again from scratch. You know, I mean, there's no good news for Sri Lankan cricket fans at the moment. Yeah. Outside of Mudashankar, and he is just like your golden god. You ride him into the future on those shiny wings. I thought he was absolutely sensational. Everything else is kind of a bit shit.
Yeah, he bowled that ripper to Rohit Sharma. That was one of the wickets of the tournament for me. And yeah, you're right. Mudashankar is the only shining light because they didn't even qualify for the Champions Trophy. And that's going to hurt because Sri Lankan cricket fans are really passionate and they really care a lot about the sport. So I feel for them. And I feel for them with this whole board situation as well. I hope that, you know, it ends quickly. We get Sri Lanka back on the field because they're one of those teams that I've always had this sort of soft corner for, both New Zealand and Sri Lanka, because they're island nations. They shouldn't be as good as they've been, right? So, I mean, I hope that things are resolved. And all I'll say about the World Cup campaign is that even if they did have Asaranga, they wouldn't have done well. That's all I'll say.
I mean, maybe he wins them out. If he has an Adam Zampa thing, and Mudashankar's taking wickets up top, and he's doing that, he probably wins them one or two more games, right? I don't know what we had them. I think I had them as best case scenario of getting five wins, but not having a good enough net run rate to get through. Maybe four wins with Hasaranga, right? They still would have been more or less not an issue in this World Cup.
Yeah, who's to say what happens next? But we hope that Sri Lankan cricket is back. Anyway, we'll take a quick break and then we still have three more teams to discuss. You're watching Uncovered with Jared and Biram. Stay tuned.
Experience the thrill of Wicket Cricket Manager. Build your dream team, make strategic decisions and dominate the leagues. Cheer for dot ball, shout at wides in this immersive cricket fantasy game. Take control of cricket right on your phone.
Welcome back to the Uncovered podcast with Biram and Jared. And well, let's go to England now. Of course, we could not have a podcast without discussing them. And the only thing that's probably in more shambles than their ODI team is their politics, but we won't go there. Anyway, you know, in the last two games, they started to get things right? Bairstow got a 50, Milan got 87, who wasn't that bad. I mean, if you have to pinpoint someone, I don't think it's David Milan. Joe Root, after having two good games at the start, finally had a good one, scored a 50 as well. But then he was reverse ramping and got bowled through the legs, which is an apt description or depiction of how England fared this World Cup, because he's nailed that shot. That is his shot. And even Wokes got a 50, right? But there were some good positive signs in the bowling. David Willey, of course, got a 3-for, ended with 100 ODI wickets and go well in retirement, David Willey. I think you were underutilized by England. And then, of course, Ben Stokes, right? Apart from, of course, the spinners who started to turn the ball finally, you know, Adil Rashid and Moeen Ali started to get some purchase off the wickets. Ben Stokes slammed 108 and then 84 in what might just be his last two ODI innings ever. And you'd have to say a little too late for the 2019 attacking champions.
Yeah. I mean, they did have a pretty soft finish to that tournament, right? Like they had Netherlands and then Pakistan, who were kind of heartbroken by that point. And so they won the last couple of games. I did think they were actually playing, like, even if you look at the Australia game, I thought they played okay in that one as well. So true. I thought by the last three, they were playing not the way they should be or anything, but certainly less crap, is the best way of putting it. Essentially, Stokes and Milan were the other one.
Ben Stokes would put it, less crap.
Yeah, exactly. Milan and Stokes were the only two who batted really well. And Stokes still had to bat like pretty slowly in order to make his runs at times in this tournament. Topley and Willie both bowled really well, and Adil Rashid bowled really well. And Chris Wokes actually had a sneaky good finish to the tournament, but it was just too late. Like, he'd already been dropped by that point. But again, how many players were good from start to end in this tournament for them? You would say Willie, but Willie didn't actually start in the side, did he? Was he in the game in the first? No.
David Willie was not starting for them. So they came to Wokes and Willie really, really late. And I think they might have
Wokes played in the first game, didn't he?
No, as a partnership, as a new partnership.
Yes, yeah.
So that happened very late in the tournament.
So they didn't have any players who were good from beginning to end in this tournament. Like Milan obviously got a couple of innings, but also had a bunch where he didn't do particularly well in the middle. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially, you know, what we saw was, and it goes back to that Bangladesh thing of, if your players aren't in form at a certain point, I'm not sure what you are supposed to do, right? You can try and light a rocket under them. And sometimes that stuff works. Sometimes throwing chairs and screaming and giving an emotional speech really, really works. And sometimes it does. I can't remember who it was, but someone was telling me, it must be someone who worked for England, who said that you get once in a World Cup or once in a test series, you get the opportunity to give a speech that actually changes things. But for most of the time, these players are just pros, right? Especially the older players, a little bit different with younger players, right? But with older players, they're just like, oh, we've heard all this before. Yeah, great. You know, we'll just try and play better. Because essentially, what else could you have said to the England team? Because they tried mass changes and it didn't work, right? They actually, I would say they pressed the panic button on their 11 way earlier than I would have assumed they would.
Yeah.
And it didn't work. And by the end, they'd kind of fumbled this lineup together that was okay. But I mean, you've got Livingston averaging 10, right? Butler averaging 15, Moeen Ali averaging 15, Bairstow averaging 23, right? Like, what are you supposed to do with that? That's like a major part of your core and none of them have made any runs. Like, this isn't, they didn't pick the wrong players. They didn't overattack. They just didn't make any runs.
Yeah, you mentioned how they clicked the panic button a bit earlier. I think when they dropped all of their all-rounders versus Afghanistan, that was that big, oh my God moment for me. I was like, oh, a team which is literally, this is the bedrock of their, I don't know, success, that you bat deep and you play the way that they play. That was like the big point where I thought, oh, hey, England are probably not going to qualify over here. But here's a question for you. Had Stokes been available for the first few games, could he have made a difference? Because he did make a difference towards the end. And Ben Stokes is that guy, right? Mr. Clutch.
Didn't he? Am I not misremembering? Didn't he play the first couple of games and look completely out of it, though?
When he came back from injury, he didn't play the first few after because of injury.
He did play. I know he got into form in the last two or three games of the tournament. But my memory was even when he was playing in the middle of the tournament, he wasn't playing particularly well. Like, I mean, I know the India game. I can't remember the others. I mean, possibly. I mean, they only had two batters who were actually in form and one of them didn't play all the games. So, yes, that would have helped. They were pretty poor with the ball against New Zealand. And then what was the other game that they played early on? Was they beat Bangladesh. They lose to Afghanistan. Yeah, maybe in that game. They weren't even in the game against South Africa. So what? Let's say, and then the Sri Lanka game. By then he was playing again, wasn't he? Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
So I don't know, mate. Maybe it gives them one extra win and they're still crap.
Yeah. I mean, they had a very, very underwhelming tournament and no one expected this. We did not believe our eyes, but slowly, you know, the more you watch them play, it felt like, yeah, this is not England. They're just having an absolute stinker. But, you know, going forward or moving forward, we've seen that Rob Key has said that, yeah, they did not prioritize ODI cricket. Joe Root has talked about scheduling ODI cricket during the blast. Am I right over there? Something along those lines. And given the aging squad, because these guys are old now, right? Where does England's ODI unit go from here?
I don't know. I mean, we don't know if the Champions Trophy is going to be a one-day tournament, right? We don't know if the next one-day World Cup will be a one-day World Cup at this point. So it's a hard thing to even factor in what they will prioritize, right? Because they won't be in a situation where, like, no one's really going to know what's going to come up next. I think that's probably, you know, a fair thing to say. So I don't know how to answer that. One thing I would say is that me and Matt Roller talked about it before the tournament, and Matt said that he was pretty excited with the fact that England had set up this template and that it would guarantee them semi-final success. Both of us knew anything could happen in the tournament, but more or less would guarantee them, you know, repeated semi-final, thing. And then you see Sam Curran and Harry Brook on the bench, and that this team isn't particularly young. I don't think the younger players coming through that I've seen look like they are going to take over in the next 3 or 4 years in a way that is going to rocket them back up the list. All the stuff that England have been doing, like things like depth charts, Well, Australia and India now do that, right? Yeah. Hunting matchups. Everyone does that because it's T20 cricket, right? Scoring fast in the middle without losing wickets. Pakistan can do that now, right? So many teams have caught up to them in so many ways. They don't have the advantage they had in 2019, and they still had to grit and grind to win that World Cup in 2019, right? So Jofra comes back, we assume, one day, although he's had another setback. That does change things a little bit, but this team isn't going to get saved by Jofra either.
Yeah, well, that was Orville Tuitenbacher's question as well. So that's answered for you, Orville. And yeah, you got a feel for Joff. It's just one injury after another. And yeah, England, all of a sudden, you know, they don't look strong anymore because all of these potential retirements puts them in a bad place. And they haven't picked Sam Hain for the West Indies. So I know that's going to rile a few people up, right? Avjeet Verma says, love the show, guys. What are the plans for podcasts after the World Cup? Well, this is a weekly podcast. We're into episode 58. So you'll get this every week, regardless of whether we have any cricket or no cricket. Because
yeah, we do.
Uncovered still.
Yeah, we do. Uncovered, we record, comes out. Monday on the YouTube and Tuesday on podcast. We do Footmarks, which comes out Wednesday on both. I do Wagon Wheel, which I record any day I can and usually comes out on Friday, I think. Yeah, Friday. Red Inca comes out on Thursday as well. Usually I do those as pre-records and not live. We've got the Double Century, so we've got heaps of podcasts. But we are, after this World Cup, we'll be having a look at our schedule and everything. We might be changing some days around. We might be adding some extra shows. We might be adding a third panelist in as well. And a fourth panelist as well. I forgot. We've got so many people lined up. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to stop. I think what I want this channel to eventually be is, seven live shows a week on this particular YouTube channel, and then also seven podcasts a week. They might not all be the same shows, or they might be or whatever, but that is the plan going ahead. This isn't something we're just doing for the World Cup. If you go back, this channel is new, but the actual shows existed on the main channel beforehand. We've just brought them across, but this channel will continue. And thank you to everyone for their support of this channel. Because when I told Bayram we're bringing all these shows over here, I think he was looking at the subscriber count going, am I going to be broadcasting to 12 people? And we're not. Like, again, tonight, this is a late at night show because it fits in with both of our schedules. And there's masses of you in the room again. So nothing but love for everyone who's come on to any of our lives throughout this World Cup or before this World Cup and hopefully then after this World Cup.
Yeah. Lots of love for you guys. And thank you for following this page. And go subscribe to the other channel as well. You know, Jared's got lots of fun videos. Dude, oh, you're really struggling with his heart. Damn.
I think I can do this one though. Is this the one?
Well, there you go. Also, you know, if we do reach that holy grail of seven pods a week, the idea is to have seven different kinds of podcasts. So we are your cricket fix. Subscribe to this channel and the other one and we've got you sorted. Anyway, let's not waste further time. We've got two more teams. The Netherlands, they missed out on Champions Trophy qualification, but they can hold their heads high with pride. You know, they won two games at this World Cup. I think that's quite an achievement for them. Scott Edwards' captaincy and his rescue jobs, they were regular features of this World Cup. Bas de Leda and Logan van Beek, they had their moments as well. They had some bad ones as well, but some good ones too. And then I was quite impressed with Engelbrecht. I think he was a really plus cricketer for the Netherlands, and as were Van Meekeren and Aryan Dutt. Aryan Dutt would have made it to Pakistan's spin attack, hands down. And even Teja Nidamanuru, the hero from the West Indies game, he scored a ton. He caught some form towards the end, scored some runs. Lots of positives to take forward, but here's the question. Now, is the future bright for Dutch cricket, or are we going to lose them to capitalism?
Look, I think they've got, I think Bas de Leda will probably play in some of the best T20 franchises in the world. I think Vikram is, you know, one of the best young batters that I know he had a shocker, but one of the best young batters will be better for being in this World Cup. Aryan Dutt looks like a legitimate player. We know they haven't had any problems with seam bowlers. You know, this wasn't the tournament for that. I think there's a lot to like for this team. Here's my thing. I think I had two wins as their best case scenario, right? Within that, they've got to two wins, and I don't think they played as well as they could have.
True.
That's a really good sign. There's a lot of kind of Ackerman, Engelbrecht, Roloff, older, you know, even Logan is probably into his 30s. Max O'Dowd is a little bit older. But they've got a nice mix of sort of those guys between the age of 29 and 34 and a bunch of younger players out there. I think they should be excited as a fan base, but T20 cricket is probably going to help and hinder them at times. They already have their own issues with county cricket. You know, if Vikram ends up being, you know, a player who goes into T20, that's going to cause a Josh Littles type situation. Baz Dalida will certainly get into that. I don't think Aaron Dutt's quite on that level, but who knows? But they've also got, young guy Pringle, who's not in this squad, who I really like. I think it's Pringle.
Is he better than Gito?
So they've got players coming through, right? Like I think they're in the best place I've seen Dutch cricket. And they're not just relying on Engelbrecht type players anymore, right? They're relying on Baz Dalida and Aaron Dutt and Vikram and these other guys coming through. That's really exciting as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've been mighty impressed. And I think that had their top order fired, Max O'Dowd needed like two innings in total. And that could have potentially won them another game. And I mean, even though they've gone out with two wins and I think they've done well, I agree they could have done better. And Arco says, Benny Howell for England team, let's go. Do not mention Benny Howell in front of Jared. That's your next 5 minutes right there. Anyway, we're on to Afghanistan, the final team left to discuss. And well, they had a groundbreaking tournament, really. If you think about it, winning 4 games out of 9, should have won 5, really. But Glenn Maxwell said no. And just to let people know, we're doing the footmarks on Maxwell. That's why he wasn't mentioned in this podcast at all. We don't want to ruin the fun. And yeah, the spin attack was always fabled. We knew it was world class, but we saw all of their players come to the fore. And I've made this point over and over and over again, but I think it needs to be spoken even more because you had the likes of Hashmatullah Shahidi and Ikram Ali Khail, and then Ibrahim Zadran. You know, he was a big one. He scored Afghanistan's first ever 100 in a World Cup. He carried his bat versus Australia. That's huge. And I think that they've done enough over here to maybe land more competitive international cricket, because that's the issue with Afghanistan, isn't it?
No. Look, I thought they were fantastic. Put it this way. Ikram Ali Khail played 7 games and I think he only batted 3 times, right? Yeah. So you have a situation straight away where their top order overperformed so much. Mm-hmm. That they didn't even have to rely on someone who looked fantastic in one of the few innings he actually did play, right? Like, made 58 with the tail and gave them a good chance there. 5 players all made runs of a sort. You know, Gurbaz was probably a disappointment, but still averaged around 30 in the tournament. Omazai with bat and with ball and in the field. Hashmatullah, I thought was really, I thought he batted better than I would ever give him credit for. It's still a low strike rate. And I think that if you want to be really, really nitpicky, it's that Hashmatullah, Ibrahim and Rama are all still plodders, right? Yeah.
So but Rehmat Shah was like a real plodder, right? He did well as per his career strike rate. Like,
don't get me wrong. But they all, I think they all had, I'm just having a look at it now. Yeah, they all had strike rates in the 70s. You know, Omazai obviously scored at nearly a run of ball. Ali Khail, I think, can probably score a little bit quicker. And we know, obviously, Gurbaz was just under a run of ball, I think, in the end. But could certainly do that. But the truth is that they've never had a core of 5 batters before, right? And now it would be hard-pressed to look at that tournament. And I would almost make the argument, because I'm a huge fan of Ali Khail as well, that they've got 6 core batters now. And that hasn't been the case in this team for a very, very long time. Ever. That's huge. The other thing I would say that is a real strength of this team is that we talk about how great their spin bowlers are. Rashid Khan took 11 wickets at 35. That's the most wickets they took of any of their spinners, right? Noor, I think, might have, what did he end up with? 5 wickets in 4 games. So yeah, I know I think he took 3 and maybe in the first game he played. So again, it wasn't like their spinners got on a bit of a run on helpful pitches, right? Their spinners actually bowled quite defensive. And that worked for them for the way that they played their cricket and everything else. Naveen had his moments. He certainly wasn't a consistent bowler. But he picked good moments to come good and help them in games. Faruqi, again, probably had a better tournament than Naveen, but they see Naveen as more as the frontliner. He chipped in, but you know, they had, I think they have, let's have a look here, between 5 wickets and 11 wickets. I think they had like 7 bowlers.
Yeah.
I mean,
also Bhargav is saying, how does Afghanistan rank among performances of associate nations in the World Cup? They're not an associate nation. They're a test playing nation.
Yeah. So they rank very low in that one.
Yeah.
Look, I think I had them as 3 wins as their high end. They should have won 5 games, if we're being honest, looking back at this tournament. And they were absolutely fantastic. Really good signs going forward. I like the fact that they didn't have to rely on madness. They relied on good cricket. And honestly, we're sitting here saying that they, you know, they ended up with the 4 wins. Was it 4 wins? Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. It was.
Yeah. They ended up with 4 wins. They should have got 5 wins. They would probably argue they should have got 6 wins because they would probably look back and think they should have beaten Bangladesh in that first game. They certainly should have won one of South Africa and Australia as a game. And they also probably were so negative at times that their net run rate didn't go up. So all those things matter a little bit from that perspective. But those are good problems to have if you're Afghanistan, right? Like, absolutely. Well, we could have won 7 games, or, you know, at worst, we could have won 6 games, and we could have had a better net run rate. We could have made the finals. I mean, what a conversation to be having about a country who didn't win a game in the last World Cup and won 1 game in their first World Cup against Scotland. And even then, that was an arsey game that they should have lost.
Yeah, they quintupled their World Cup wins in one edition. And like you said, they should have won that game versus Australia and even Bangladesh. You know, I think that had they met Bangladesh later in the tournament, they would have won that game for sure. But they've really matured as a batting side. And I remember we used to call them a spoiler team. I think they were better than that. In fact, I know that Pakistan finished above Afghanistan in the points table, but I think Afghanistan had a better World Cup than Pakistan.
Oh,
I would
definitely.
Go on to say that. Yeah,
no, definitely. Because as I said, the Australia game is a coin flip in the end because of how Australia won it. You know, if Maxwell had to come off the field or been caught, right, Afghanistan just win that game easily. The South Africa game as well, perhaps if Marco Janssen is playing and not Andile Pethlakweyo at number 7, who knows what happens there. And as you said with the Bangladesh game, they'll be looking back at that Bangladesh game just being like, how did we manage to get in a situation like that so early on in that game? So I definitely think they had a much better tournament. You know, they had a much stronger best 6 games than Pakistan's best 6 games, right?
Yes. And I mean, it's a watershed moment for them. I think they'll draw back, you know, on the performances from this World Cup, and the future is bright. I see them making a World Cup semi-final, if not in ODIs, because we don't know if we'll have another World Cup or not, or two, but in T20s for sure, right? And just before we end this, I really, really do want to talk about Azmatullah Umrzai, right? He scored an unbeaten 97 versus South Africa, nearly scored Afghanistan's second 100 at the World Cup. Mm. And he was very good with the new ball versus Australia. I think he's been underutilized in that regard, and good pace bowling all-rounders. They're such a rare commodity in cricket, right? And a priceless one, if you come to think of it. We can go through history and that's been the case. Mm. And I think, or I want to ask you actually, have Afghanistan potentially found, you know, their Hardik Pandya? I mean, he could definitely be developed into something of the sort.
The Walmart Hardik Pandya, perhaps. I don't know if he's quite at that level of a cricketer. He's got a lot of development yet to make. I think makes some weird batting choices at times. I think we might have talked about it on another episode, or maybe I talked about it. He's got a bit of like young Dan Christian where, like, he can bowl brilliant balls, but sometimes you're like, why are you bowling? You don't need to bowl that. Just bowl a normal seam-up delivery here. But he can bat, he can bowl, and he can field, right? And let's be honest, they're not a very good fielding side.
So not at all
of those three things are positives to them. I don't know what his ceiling is.
Pratik Jha is saying he's just a younger Gulbuddin Naib. Wow, that's harsh.
No, I mean, Gulbuddin could never bat at this level and never had the pace bowling. Gulbuddin's a great athlete, but not particularly a great moving athlete in the field. So he's already better than Gulbuddin at three different things.
Hmm.
The question is, if he's going to be really useful, he needs to be good enough to be the fifth bowler, right? Hmm. And I think at the moment he's a sixth bowler, right? In a good team. We're talking about a team that's pushing for finals and stuff, which is where we're putting them in because they were pushing for finals. Now, he should be the sixth bowler in a good team, and the fifth bowler is what they need. If he's their fifth bowler and he can bat in the top 5, they have found something truly special. And then you've got, then the other really exciting thing for world cricket is that Bazdalida and Omazai are both playing for teams that are, you know, ranked lower in the world. And yet they're both found bowling all-rounders at a young age who might stick around for a long period of time. But a lot can go right and a lot can go wrong for both of them. But they're endlessly talented, those two.
Yeah, I mean, I hope both of those guys get IPL gigs and other franchise gigs because that can really expedite their development. And I love pace bowling all-rounders, so I want to see both of these guys do well. Ritik Tiwari is saying, hello, Behram and Jared. Well, we're about to say goodbye. This has been a marathon podcast. We obviously did not want to rob you guys of any exit interviews. Had to talk about every single team. But thank you so much for joining us, all of you guys in the live chat. Thank you for interacting with us. You know, subscribe to this channel, subscribe to Jared's other channel, send in super chats. We'll answer your questions. It's been an absolute pleasure. And yeah, we'll catch you now next week once the World Cup is done. So quickly, Jared, who's winning it?
New Zealand in a super over. Overthrows.
All right, I'm going to say South Africa beats India to break the hex. There you have it. Hot takes 101. We're done with the Uncovered for today. We'll catch you soon enough. That's all for tonight. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are many other extras as well, including a Discord channel. There's a link to those in the show notes. Please review, subscribe, and tell all your friends about our show. Word of mouth is the best way of making our podcast grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bharat Sundaresan and Behram Kazi. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston. Each episode is produced by Ishit Kuberka at Sound Potion Studio. The team from 42 help us out with the video side. Orajoti Senapayu and Maida Akam, both producing podcasts, while Mukunda Bandredi is the head of our YouTube content. If you are a podcaster who happens to waffle on and you need a way to cut down your long-form content, Memento FM is here to save the day. They turn your lengthy media into bite-sized chunks for even the most time-starved audience. Start using Memento FM today.